Hello, this is Hit Pause, a podcast made in San Francisco with more questions than answers. And welcome back to Hit Pause. Today, we're in conversation with Caroline Neto. She lives just a little south of San Francisco in a beautiful, beautiful city called Half Moon Bay. Hello, Caroline.
Hi, Hervé.
It's wonderful to have you because I have known you for many, many years, decades, actually. I used to work with your husband in the tech world. He's a tech executive in the Silicon Valley. And to me, for our audience, you have an amazing lens cutting at the intersection of the Silicon Valley, being a mother, raising kids, looking and observing this Silicon Valley from its heart and yet a little outside of it. So that's a unique position. So welcome. Thank you. We're going to start with a little bit of introductions and having you tell us your history, what you've done in tech, and as a community volunteer.
Okay. So I managed a help desk and desktop support for a bank for many years. And then I was a director at a startup software company and managed the technical support for that, as well as did the training. So I would do 2 and 3 day in-person training.
Oh, that's what, so you've known the world of the small company and the world of a large company as well, right?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. We'll talk a little bit about that in the second part about the learning and what happens when you learn as a kid or as an adult and what are the lessons, differences. So tell us a little bit about your community and volunteer work that you're doing as well.
So I've been volunteering at the girls' schools for, I have two daughters, two mm-hmm. teenagers, and I've been volunteering at their schools since they were in preschool. So either on the board of the PTO for all of their schools, I either chaired or volunteered with many fundraising opportunities and events to raise money for the PTOs. And then now I'm also on the board of our community theater in Half Moon Bay.
Oh, wow. So you're at the intersection of the kids' world and the parents' world and the teacher world and the administration world, right?
Exactly. Kind of all of it.
Is that going swimmingly every time, or sometimes there are some sparks flying?
Oh, yeah, there's some challenges. Mostly it's good, but yeah.
All right. And then you're of course, the wife of my dear friend, Hisa, and you have a chance to look at the tech side and the conversations around the family dinner table that he's bringing in as well, right? So, and Hisa is also bicultural, which is to me very, I resonate with that since I'm bicultural, French-born American. His size, Japanese-American. So you have a very interesting mix of perspectives and culture in your family dinner table environment, right?
Yes, we do. Yeah.
And you would say your kids are considering themselves of one culture, multiple culture, international culture, and you're traveling a lot. So what would you say the kids are exposed to?
They're primarily American, right? We live here. That's all of their friends are American. But we do travel a lot. They're exposed to the Japanese language through their dad and their grandparents. And then we also travel to Japan. We do a lot of other international travel just to widen their horizons. I don't think travel is ever a bad thing.
Yeah. So in the last episode, I was exploring a little bit the construction of a young brain, of a human brain, and the build-up of a human psyche through learning, through playful experiences, through those ages in childhood and ages in adulthood and teenage years, and how we as human beings, we think about or experience novelty. I wanted to ask you, as a mother, obviously you're now raising two beautiful daughters, teenager. When you looked at their own learning, the joy of a kid, do you see, is it 50-50 happiness and 50% chagrin and crying and stomping your feet because the kid is not allowed to do what they want? What's the learning experience seen by a mother through the ages of a kid and the evolution of the different phases of learning? Maybe that's a very broad question. I've been told sometimes I'm asking too broad questions.
It's pretty broad.
but it's for just setting the stage of, I'm curious about how you as a mother think about all of this.
It's interesting because when they're young, the learning is so accelerated, right? From baby to early childhood, elementary school. One of my favorite stories is when my oldest daughter was a little over a year. We did a lot of signing with her and with my younger daughter as well, but they're completely different personalities. And when she understood that a sign, that she could communicate with us with a sign, it was, you could literally see her light up. Like she was 11 months old maybe at that time. Mm-hmm. And so for her, it was like, they can understand what I'm trying to say. And she would learn two or three signs a day. And from more to water, to milk, to hungry, all of the animals, dog, horse, pig, stars, moon, she would just point things out and want to know what that was and what that sign was. And when we would read to her, we would do the signs for the, you know, like Hippos Go Berserk is one of the favorite stories. It's the Sandra Boynton Hippos Go Berserk. Every parent knows that story. And so we would do the signs for that, and she would make the signs with us. And my most favorite experience with her with signs is we were outside one day and a dog walked by. It was a greyhound. And I asked if she could come say hi. And she pet the dog and she looked at me and she made the sign for horse. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. And I said, no, it's a dog.
Yeah, it's a
and
big
she
dog.
Did. Yeah. And she did the sign for horse. And then, so actually she had seen it out the window. She had done the sign for horse. And I was like, no, honey, mm-hmm. That's a dog. That's a dog. And she was confused and kept doing the sign for horse. So the next week we went outside. And she was able to pet it. And she pet it and looked at me with this wonder and did the sign for dog. So she was like, that is a dog. You know, so we were able to have this interaction, which we never would have been able to have had she not signed because she wasn't speaking it. So
That is fascinating. So you're talking, first of all, we're recording and we're just recording the audio, but for all the people listening, you could see the lighting on Caroline's face right now, because this is a story. You're conveying precisely this question of when there is learning, there is joy with the discovery of a meaning and the mirroring to you. That communication, you're no longer alone in the world. You're part of something that connects you with you to the world. It's a beautiful story.
Thanks. It was hugely powerful. And it's my favorite. She had 50 or 60 signs by the time she stopped really signing and could speak. My younger daughter, she had, I think, 12. She's much easier going. She didn't have as much to say, as long as she could tell me when she was hungry, when she was thirsty. But you know, she's like, yeah, we're good. 12 is fine.
and what about the more challenging learning experiences or the more challenging moments when do you think that there's the other aspect when confronted with with no from mommy and daddy or from something that's frustrating. We all have those images, maybe from our own childhood memories, about those moments when there's frustration and it induces the bodily reaction to the stampede, the, you know, trampling. Were there particular ages? Where do you see the moment when the kid realizes that there's a certain normalization of the reaction and that society expects the little boy not to cry or the little girl to tamper her feelings? How does that process work as an observer and a participant also?
Those are a lot of questions in that.
Yeah, that's all right. That's the point.
So, that's a hard thing to answer. And I think that that's a hard thing for me to answer because we've never been a family that does the boys don't cry, you know, so we've never done sort of gender normalization things with our kids, or gender expectations, not normalizations. Yeah. That's a harder thing to say. They probably got it a little bit at school, but we live in the Bay Area. So even 15 years ago, things were less rigid, I think, than when I was growing up or when you were growing up. So I don't really know that we saw a lot of that. I mean, we did get their frustration. Part of the reason we signed is the main reason is so that they could communicate, because so much of a child's frustration is that they have these, especially as babies, they have these thoughts, but they don't have any way to express them. And so it leads to a huge frustration. And I saw this with my older sister's daughter. Until she could speak, she would get super, super, super frustrated. And I just remember thinking, I don't want that. We want to be able to mitigate that with our kids, to give them an opportunity. So we didn't have a huge spikes of that when they were really young, because they were able to communicate what they needed and what they wanted. We did have it when they were sort of feeling their oats and trying to decide they were the bosses. And so we would have to put in some pretty significant boundaries for them. So that was challenging. And 4, I think, is the age that was probably the most difficult for both of my girls, for different reasons. But
testing the boundaries. We'll come back to that theme, and for sure, future episodes of the podcast, I'll explore the boundary setting. I'll explore the containers of emotions, and then putting a container of emotion under pressure, and what happens when the lid of the container explodes and the explosion of emotions comes out. Let's fast forward a little bit to your sense of the adulthood learning, and fast forward, accelerate 2 decades into your work in a big bank and a small company with trying to teach adults new tricks or how to react or respond to a frustrated customer in a different way. Do you think an adult learns the same way than a kid?
I don't think we do. I think that from what I've seen, kids are so open. Everything is a learning experience, right? I mean, so many things are brand new all the time. And I think as adults, we sort of become jaded because we don't have all of these brand new experiences. When I was doing the training on the software, a lot of times, especially initially, I would get pushback. Like, people didn't want to learn a new process. They didn't want to learn the new way to do things. But as we went through training, they could see the value in that. So I think that oftentimes adults will sort of try and push back a little bit, but they don't feel the need to do that, learn something new.
It's fascinating, this pleasure of learning and this importance of the novelty. In one of the future conversations that I'll have, I'll be talking to one of my friends in Europe who's a coach, and he stresses a lot in these conversations when we chat about the importance of play and the reintroduction of play into the adult learning. We too often go through corporate training, which is longish, repetitive, full of PowerPoint slides, and we forget the importance of the play in that learning. So thank you. We're going to take a little pause, and then we'll be introducing technology in the life of those kids and see what happens. We'll be right back. And now let's go to a short break to hit pause, reflect, or just continue. And welcome back to our episode and conversation with Caroline Nato. Good chatting with you. You really blew me away with the story of the sign language. We were talking a little bit during our intermission here. It's not only a beautiful story, but something that I did not know about you. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to learn good or have good ideas about it. So let's inject. So we have kids, we're happy, they're learning in a loving environment, and then we're interjecting social media and we're giving them a phone, and suddenly the world changes. You know that one of the themes of this podcast series is really, what does that mean, this human-machine interaction? I believe that the human adapts much faster than the machine, and it's a maybe symbiotic, maybe toxic relationship, maybe both. How do you see this as a mother? Social media, phones in the hands of your kids, and the impact that it has on them?
Well, I feel like because we come from technical backgrounds, my husband and I, he and I, that we are a lot stricter than most of the other parents of the kids that my kids are friends with. They did get phones fourth or fifth grade, but that was specifically just for safety. So I think it was fifth grade. And we have a lot of rules around them, especially when they were younger. And social media, we're not big proponents of social media for kids. So my oldest daughter is 16, and she has Snapchat, but she doesn't use it very much, hardly at all. The only reason she even had that, but didn't get it until she was in eighth grade, was because a lot of her friends do communicate the texting through Snapchat. Mm-hmm. She has Instagram, but she's just not that involved in social media, and we like that. We don't want that environment for her. And my youngest is 13, and she does not have social media. We also, with phones and phone usage, I mean, right now it's sort of completely out the window because of COVID, and they're allowed so much more online time than they've ever been allowed before, mm-hmm. because that's how they interact with their friends, is they'll play video games or whatever, but they'll be talking while they're playing. But you know, we have no phones are allowed in the bedroom. So they can have them in the bedroom, but not at night. Like the phones have to be upstairs, plugged in. They're locked down on what they can and can't do. So HESA's got that pretty well locked down. I mean, it's a powerful tool, but it can also be.
Yeah. It's how you set the boundaries is what you're really saying. And the fact that maybe the addictive or the addictionability, I'm inventing a new word here.
Of the tool, works for me.
of the tool, you controlled it fairly tightly in the formative years so that they didn't grow up to be two young girls of 15 years old who are already addicted to the tool. It's astonishing to hear that story. Do you think that's the norm out there?
What we're doing?
Yes.
No, it's absolutely not the norm. No, I know that my kids' friends are, they have their phones in their room at night. It's hard for me to have my phone in the room at night because it's distracting. So it's would be terrible for them. My niece would get texts in the middle of the night, and she would wake up and respond to texts. And that's just, it's not healthy, right? It's just not healthy to have that much focus on it. But I do think that we are the exception, not the norm. Most everybody allows their kids.
It's a big question in the Silicon Valley. We're starting to see a slow emergence of what I would call a consciousness movement. There is the Humane Tech, the Humane Technology Group and Society. They just put out a movie on Netflix that everybody's talking about, The Social Dilemma. There is a beginning of realization that technology is now making an entire new generation of younger brains that are thinking, behaving, interacting, communicating differently. Michel Serres, the former, he died a couple of years ago, the philosopher who was a teacher at La Sorbonne and Stanford, wrote a book called Lille Poussette, and in French, thumb is pouce. And okay. So we have the Lille Poussée, who's a traditional French kids folklore story. And then Poussette is really his granddaughter. And she's constantly on the phone with her thumbs. And all she knows how to interact with the world is through her thumbs, texting, asking questions on Google, and looking into the phone to provide all the answers. Do you think as a mother, you're seeing different behaviors in your kids from their friends when it's time to have attention span, to be able to communicate, to engage, to be part of a conversation with adults at the dinner table? Or do you already see the symptoms, I guess, of this change that the technology is bringing to all of us?
I do. I do see a difference. I think it depends on the personality of the kids involved. But I do see, for example, when my older daughter, I believe it was for her 13th birthday, we had a party for her at a friend's house where the kids, several girls, were able to come and spend the night. And they were able to have their phones. But once it was 9 o'clock, I was like, all right, ladies, phones in the basket. And one of her friends flipped out. I know I have to have my phone. I'm like, no, you don't. 9 o'clock, you guys are getting ready for bed. You know, they were going to watch movies and that sort of thing. I'm like, you don't need your phone. Well, my mom might need to get a hold of me. Your mom has my number. You don't need your phone. And she was super twitchy the whole night. Like, she really couldn't handle not having her phone. And I think they were 13 at that point. And that's not okay.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's okay.
You're describing the behavior of an addict who's on withdrawal.
Right. Absolutely. It was absolutely like that. And I kept going, you'll be fine. And she kept coming up with different excuses. I'm like, no. You know, so it was, and so the other girls were all like, oh, okay. But I'm sure that she ended up not having a great time. Only because of that. I mean, we had a swimming pool and, you know, they tried on my friend's clothes and she just, it was like she was jonesing for the phone.
Yeah. So there's a fascinating question, which we'll, I'm sure, explore on the podcast with lots of other conversations. But it's no secret in the technology world of the Silicon Valley that 5G is upon us, of course. Everybody's realizing that now they can have the next version of their phone with 5G connectivity. This is the new standard in telecommunications. And 5G, one of the things that is also intersecting, I should say, is augmented reality, because all those phones have a camera. And of course, all those social media applications can look at the world and make a map of the world. Maybe that's my day job. And we're going to be having, within a couple of years, an entire generation of kids and teenagers that are going to realize that the physical reality that they see with their human eyes is only one layer of reality, by opposition to what you can superimpose on top of it. Today, when you look at augmented reality, it's kind of still a toy. It's not exactly perfect or precise. Tomorrow, you'll be able to put a filter or an additional piece of reality on your phone and see what's there. Touristic information when you're traveling to see the Eiffel Tower. And now suddenly you point at it with your phone and the Eiffel Tower on your phone is maybe better than the reality. What do you think as a mother that does to the conversation at the dinner table around what is reality?
That's a tough question. That's a tough question. And I think that for us, it just means we focus a lot on putting the technology down. And so I think that's where that will come in, is how important it is to not have it constantly in your face. So yes, you can get information. Yes, you can see things in a different way, but that's not always the best way to do it. So yeah, I think it's going to be, my word for this year is interesting. Like it's going to be interest. That'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see the fallout from all of the isolation from COVID, right? I think that's going to be interesting. And so I think that that's what will happen. We've talked to the girls about how quickly technology has changed in my lifetime, in our lifetimes. For example, I remember when VHS and beta tapes came out, right? I mean, that was a big deal. It was a big deal. And the girls, like, you don't understand. And Aya would say to me, my youngest will say, you know, mom, when you were a kid and you had a phone, I'm like, oh, no, no, no phones, no email, no computers even. When I was really quite young, I was like, we didn't have, I was like, well, how did you do research? It was called an Encyclopedia Britannica. So the way that technology has changed, excuse me, and accelerated, I'm excited to see what happens, but also a little nervous about it. I'm a little concerned about the ethics really the ethics around technology and what it will be in the future.
All right. This is a perfect transition. We didn't script it. To talk a little bit about in our next part of our conversation, we'll take a short break, to talk about the school environment, the education environment, and how we widen what one family does to what you see through your community work, parent-teacher association work is happening in today's school system. We'll be right back. And now let's go to a short break to hit pause, reflect, or just continue. And we're back with Caroline for what is turning to be a wonderful conversation. The last part, I just wanted to go last even a little longer. We were ending our second part with this question of, okay, what happens around the school environment? Because at some point of time, as parents, you let your kids go out in the little world, and the little world is a school. We talked about the peer pressure. How do you think schools and teachers today are equipped or having a conversation around the impact of social media in the world. And here I'm pleading my absolute ignorance. I'm not a parent, so I do not even know whether this is an active conversation in the schools, whether the parents are pushing it, whether the teachers are pushing it, whether the kids are doing what they want and everybody's running behind them. How is it working?
I don't know that it's a big topic of conversation in the schools with the teachers, to be honest. I know that as parents, we talk about it with our kids and with their friends. But I don't know. I believe there's some periphery conversation. Some, you know, social media is not a good thing is probably what they say, is what I, which I don't necessarily agree with. I think that it can be good. I know that there have been conversations about when it's out there, it's out there. And even if you delete it, it doesn't mean it goes away. It can still be found. I know that's a conversation that we have and have had often with our kids. So I do know that there's some of that, but there's not a lot of conversation about social media, etc.
The each time I come across it or it comes in the conversation, it seems to be that it's ad hoc, it's episodic, it's typically driven by the goodwill or the foresight, or sometimes both, of teachers that recognize there might be a problem and that teaching kids how to read, decipher, and filter the information that comes to them on the internet can be a topic, but I'm not hearing an institutionalized line item on the curriculum in a specific grade that the kids have to go through that tackles that. Am I right?
You're right. There's nothing that says that. There's nothing in the curriculum that I've seen that tackles that.
And yet, when you live in the corporate world, as you well know, when you manage a team, when you manage information, you always have to start asking yourself, and you realize this is part of the growing into a managerial role, of understanding what is the source of the information you're getting, how do you have to filter, weigh it, ponder it. The best managers, the best leaders that I've seen always... It took me a long time to learn that. I was young and not understanding why my boss was asking the same question to five different people. I was frustrated like a young kid at the time. I gave you the answer. And it took me a long time to realize, no, he's actually getting a blend of perspective to try to understand what is really going on.
Right.
And that's a life skill. I never went through business school with a class on information theory, communication theory, disinformation, misinformation. And maybe right now, Russia is taking advantage of all of us precisely because we don't go through that kind of training.
Well, I think that's exactly the case. All you have to do is look at what's happening in politics in the US right now. And you have people who are getting information that is patently false, like absolute garbage, but they fully believe it. And it's almost like, well, I saw it on the internet, so that means it must be true. When we know that's completely inaccurate, right? So I don't know I do know that there's nothing really out there for kids right now in the schools. And I think that the schools, just in general, tend to try and play catch up, especially around technology. There's no way that the kids are so far ahead of the schools on the technology side of things that there isn't anything out there that is telling them how to look at the information, how to look for, I know that they need to cite multiple sources for things, so that's good, but you can find multiple sources that support your preconceived notions, right?
Very good point. It's been a Silicon Valley myth, maybe, that the answer is only and always in technology. I remember in the beginning of the 1990s when some of the early companies, even Oracle at the time was already existing. They came up with the idea of the network computer, where I started working with your husband, Issa, on those cheaper devices that were promised for the school and education and having one for every kid. And then the funding never came. And then the next technology wave came. So there's always this tug of war and this gap in the Silicon Valley between the promise of new technology and what really happens on the ground. In your experience working with teachers, do you think the teachers are today addressing the emotional side of things, the learning, the human learning, the curation, or they're just having so much to do and just to make sure that the kids have a school book and the basis of the basics of the education that they don't even care? I guess what I'm asking is, do you think it's a financial resource problem, a political will problem, or lack of time for addressing this revolution we're seeing in education to these days?
So in the girls' schools, they do have technology. So they have Chromebooks available for all of the kids if they need them. And right now, all learning is online. So we choose not to have Chromebooks because we have enough technology. Our kids don't need the Chromebooks, so we leave those for other children. So for the last several years, the girls have had some of their lessons on a Chromebook. So even in elementary school, they do some of their lessons on Chromebooks. All of the standardized testing is now done on Chromebooks and has been for several years. So the teachers are able to manage sort of that side of it. Nobody really gets into the emotional aspect of what the technology means. I think that's not a matter of funding necessarily. It might be a matter of training. I mean, frankly, teachers don't get into teaching to be on technology. So that's not their deal, right? That's not what they want to be doing. So right now is a huge challenge because some of them are doing great with this switch to online learning for now. Some are less than great because it's not what they signed up for. It's not in their wheelhouse. It's not what they do. So I think part of it is they don't know. Part of it is they have so much that they have to teach, they can't focus on one more thing. And part of it's probably training as well.
Yeah, and understanding, giving them the tools to be addressing those changes. We explored in the first season of the podcast the lag of the privacy laws, the lag of the legal construct that should be there now for all those novel technologies, those new social media sites, which are frankly arguably publishers. And so there is a certain rising tide of recognition that content has to be curated, filtered a little bit more. But the political sphere is completely behind. And I can see that on that education front for educating the new minds of the future decades, that's lagging as well. We'll finish on, I guess, on a. Are you hopeful for the future, or finding the future interesting and you're still on the fence?
No, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. I mean, I have to be hopeful, right? It's there are times that it's a struggle to be hopeful right now. But I am hopeful. I'm hopeful. The kids, you know, my kids, obviously I'm biased, but my kids are amazing. but kids are amazing. They're amazing. Their thought process, the way they look at things, so I'm very hopeful for the future and for where we're going. But I do think we need to catch up. And I'm not sure how to do that.
All right. That leaves us plenty to explore in future episodes and with other conversations. We're leaving on a high note of optimism and fun and joy and playfulness. What a beautiful way to finish. Thank you, Caroline, for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Hervé.
And we'll see each other or listen to each other in another episode of Hit Pause coming soon. Thank you, everybody. This podcast is a simple way of sharing my thoughts. It is a personal endeavor, nothing more. A way to connect. The views and opinions represented in this podcast are solely mine. They are in no way, nor should they be assumed to be shared, supported, endorsed by my employer, the sponsors of this show, Anchor.fm, where it is hosted, and all the distributors thereof. You may find more information, links, pictures, videos, documents, and more, which may have been referenced in this podcast, on my website at www.uteza.com/podcast. There, it feels so much better after saying all of this. And so, it's time to part ways, at least for now. Until next time, time to say goodnight, time to hit pause.